organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Sliwa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Sliwa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New York.
Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
Okay, I get the beat, I get the flow. Not necessarily 5-star top shelf, top 40 with a bullet. But this is a song that was dedicated to Oprah Winfrey a long time ago called Dear Oprah. On the line to discuss what has been the talk of America after Oprah Winfrey's appearance and receiving the Cecil B. DeMille Lifetime Achievement Award at the Golden Globes, followed by her rousing speech to America and many calling for her to run for the presidency and challenging Donald Trump in 2020, is Errol Lewis, host of Inside City Hall, which I appear on with my debate partner, Hirsten Barrero, every Wednesday, both at 7, and if you can't catch it at 7 on New York 1, you can catch it at 10. And also columnist for the New York Daily News, New York's hometown newspaper. Thanks for jumping on board again, Errol.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right, well, first off, I want to test your musical acumen.
Uh-huh.
And compare this Dear Oprah song found by my producer, Justin B. Love, to what was the rage for Barack Obama when he was running for office.
Oh, Obama girl, I remember that.
All right, so this is...
She was a phenomenon for about 5 minutes, yeah.
Yes, she was, but this is sort of like Dick Clark's Remember American Bandstand, Pick It or Dish It.
Well, you know what? Of the two, I like the Obama girl better. I just remember the whole thing. It's sort of vivid. This other thing, I don't know, sounds a little mushy, actually.
Okay.
And, you know, sooner or later, Oprah's going to get, you know, every entertainer in America to sing her praises.
All right, but now in your column in today's Daily News, you indicate that America gave Oprah a shot. Why Winfrey could turn out to be a great foil to Donald Trump if, in fact, she runs. Mm. Why did you come to those conclusions?
Well, you know, look, here's my theory, is that almost every president, especially if they're switching parties, is running in reaction to their predecessor, right? So you have the Great Depression in the early 1930s. The answer to Herbert Hoover is FDR. You have in the 1950s, things are kind of slow and sort of plodding along. In the Eisenhower administration, the nation goes in the other direction with a shot of adrenaline in the form of John F. Kennedy, and so on down the line. After the disgrace of the Nixon impeachment, you get Jimmy Carter, who's literally a Sunday school teacher, and he puts out a book called I'll Never Lie to You, and says he's going to restore honesty and integrity to the White House. He gets elected. They run into economic problems. Here comes Ronald Reagan, promising to sort of have America stand tall once again and cut taxes, and on and on and on and on, right down to this day. And so the question for me is, if you want to get rid of Donald Trump, and that's what Democrats are looking for, and that's what Oprah would represent, well, it depends on what the problem is. Is the problem that he's personally kind of vulgar, personally undisciplined, and keeps tweeting and insulting people and acting petty and childish? Or is the problem his policies? Is the problem the shutdown of immigration? Is the problem that he is involved with the Russians? You know, depending on what you think the problem is, Oprah might be the solution.
But Oprah has not been very open in public about her life the way Donald Trump always has been. You know, Donald Trump, he's like Len's lice. You invited him years ago. He was there. It didn't matter. Yeah. Oprah is very selective, very protective of her personal life. You know now a presidential campaign is 2 years in the making.
Right.
Can she stand up to that day-to-day constant scrutiny from bloggers, self-appointed journalists, the Fox News channel, the alt-right, everyone that will want to knock her off her pedestal?
Well, that's the question, or that's one of the big questions, and it's an interesting one. Can she take a punch is really what you're asking, right? Well, you know, Oprah's brand is that everybody loves Oprah. Right? She does things like give everybody a car, right? So you know, there's nothing to complain about there. Now, if you start announcing, you know, I don't know, you want to move the American embassy from Jerusalem back to Tel Aviv. Okay, now you got a problem. Mm. If you announce you want to change immigration policy, now you got a problem. Now you got 48% of the country at least who are going to violently disagree with you on some of these things. You start talking about raising taxes, people are going to freak out. So. We don't know if she's in it in that way, if she's ready to really fight for what she believes in. Because if you look at the books, I think she's got her name on, you know, at least half a dozen books. They're all inspirational, things that nobody could take issue with. Things like, you know, be your best self and, you know, speak your truth and all that kind of stuff.
Sort of Deepak Chopra kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, exactly. In fact, it's funny you should mention him, because one of the things I find striking about Oprah is that the way she made her money, even that contrasts with Donald Trump, right? With Oprah, she makes money for everybody else.
Hmm.
You come on her show as an author, now you've got a bestseller instantly. You're a millionaire. You know, she made stars out of some of her side players like Dr. Oz and Dr. Phil. Contrast that with Donald Trump and The Apprentice, where he humiliates and gets rid of almost everyone, right, ritualistically. It's all about him. Nobody wins except him, really. It's a very different kind of approach to all of this.
Could she conceivably, Errol Lewis, run somewhat of a stealth campaign by claiming, hey, look, you liked Barack Obama for 8 years. Many of you wanted his wife, Michelle, to run. Mm. I'm a combination of the both. I'm really, because I weaned them. I promoted them. I lived with them in Chicago. Mm. I saw how Barack Obama and Michelle worked together as a team.
Yeah.
Vote for me and you get a combination of Barack Obama and Michelle Obama.
You know what? Actually, that's quite smart. That's actually quite smart. Yeah. If you wanted to make the case for a third Obama term, she represents that, you know, like literally, right, physically, just because she's from Chicago. She was a big backer of Obama. She has some of the same appeal that Michelle Obama had. That's actually kind of interesting. Now, personally, I don't know if that would work.
Mm.
You know, look, here's what Oprah ought to do. I didn't have room in the column to say all of this, but here's what she ought to do. She ought to convene lots of people, because everyone will come when Oprah calls.
Sure.
And work through the policies that the Democratic Party might want to take to the voters in the fall election. You know, what's real and what's not? You know, I mean, the Russia thing, you can't really run a campaign based on that in a local district. What are you going to talk about? Do you really want to talk about immigration? Do you want to talk about taxes? So, you know, what's it going to be? So they should try and get their act together, number one. And then number two, she ought to go out and campaign for the Democratic candidates that she wants to help succeed. It's worth doing in and of itself just so she can get out
now,
there and see if she likes campaigning.
When, if she was serious, would she have to sit down with the Altacaca Bernie Sanders, who feels he's entitled now after running such a great race against the Clinton machine?
Well, listen, I don't know if she doesn't have to sit down with anybody she doesn't want to, honestly, you know, because if the minute somebody does a poll, and I'm sure somebody's out there polling right now, the minute somebody does a poll, she will blow away Bernie Sanders and everybody else. I mean, I'm confident of that. She routinely shows up in the polls as one of those most admired people in the country, if
yes.
not the world.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie Sanders and everybody else had better hope, if they really want to run for president in 2020, they better hope that she either gets behind them or gets out of the way, because she immediately, I think, can take up a lot of oxygen. She'll get all the media attention, I mean, right off the bat. That alone could hobble somebody else's campaign. So, I don't think she has to talk to anybody if she doesn't want to. That's the beauty of being Oprah, right?
If you're the president, Donald Trump, do you encourage this? Because you know how difficult it is for a novice to get through the process, having himself being through the trials and tribulation of a race that, let's face it, in some instances he got lucky on in certain instances, and in the other case it happened to be Hillary that everybody despised.
Yeah, if I'm Donald Trump, or if I'm supporting Donald Trump, I want her to get out there so that I can pin her to the wall on what are called wedge issues that divide people from their base. You know, here's one, for example, I've already noticed. She's given out a lot of money. She's given out over $400 million, according to Forbes. One of the causes that she supports is charter schools. Now, the teachers union, which is a very important player in the Democratic Party, they're not going to be too happy about that. So if I'm Trump, I would play that up. I would say, well, you know, she supports charter schools just like I do. Maybe Oprah and I can get along. That would freak out everybody on the Democratic side. He could sow a lot of mischief. But I'll tell you one thing, though, Curtis. One thing that Donald Trump proved is that if you've got a private plane and you really want to go home and sleep in your own bed every night, you can run a national campaign without staying in every dingy, you know, Holiday Inn near the state fair in all of these early states. You don't really have to do it that way.
And you could set the day in motion with your Twitter account. You could start the day and end the day just by tweeting nonsense at times.
Well, well considered. You know, she's a lot more strategic than he is. I get the feeling that Oprah is a more systematic strategist than Donald Trump, who sort of always operates from the gut, or openly operates from the gut. But you know, she's no slouch. I mean, you know what? Let me pull it up while I'm talking to you. Yeah, she's got 41 million Twitter followers. So she's got a platform. She's got a platform that is comparable to his, and she ain't president of the United States. So, you know, at least not yet, right?
Well, do appreciate that. That's Errol Lewis. He's host of Inside City Hall on New York One. If you get Spectrum, you got to eyeball it, because every Wednesday night I appear with my debate partner, Herson Barrero, both at 7 and 10 with Errol as a moderator. And he's also columnist of New York's hometown newspaper, The Daily News.
Curtis Sliwa.
He's a man with people.
Between the Scylla and Charybdis of commentary.
The Drive at 577 WABC.
You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. Your next stop, the Twilight Zone.
I'm proud to be here today to tell you that the state of our state is very good and without question, much, much better than it was 8 years ago.
Is that the Twilight Zone? Is that an episode in Trenton today for Chamu El Jefe, Chris Christie's final address to both houses? Or was this the Chris Christie that I was listening to?
Today, budgets have been balanced for 8 years in a row. Today, there are over 10,000 fewer state employees. Today, discretionary spending is nearly $2 billion less than it was 10 years ago.
Why is it that I'm confused? I've been tracking Chamu El Jefe, Chris Christie, and I find that he's like a beached whale. So let me find somebody who can sort of be a mediator in all of this. Paul Molschein, columnist for the Star Ledger. Thanks for jumping on board again into our Twilight Zone, Paul.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, was I right to act like Rod Serling in the Twilight Zone in listening to Chris Christie's final statements to the legislature in talking about what a great eight-year run he had?
Well, you know, he did do a lot of good stuff that mainly consisted of negating the bad stuff the Democrats would have done, you know. They just have one bad idea after another, one more tax-raising idea after another, and no way to come up with the money. And so, you know, he had some right to pat himself on the back, and he went out of his way to warn Murphy not to essentially be a tool of the unions, which Murphy already is, I mean, obviously, when we have this 2% property tax cap and a 2% cap on settlements, you know, arbitration settlements, which, of course, you have to cap the settlements if you're going to cap the taxes. And he went out of his way, adding to his script, the 2% cap worked, don't change it. That was not in the written text of the And then he went on to say about the other cap, if it expires, property taxes will skyrocket again. Our progress is at real risk, and our governor-elect has refused to ask the legislature to act before this cap expired. You know, Murphy's gotten really a little nutty here because he got all the support from the unions to get elected, but he doesn't seem to realize that once you get elected, you can turn your back on the people who helped you and screw them. That's how politics works. You know?
But Paul, did the outgoing governor, Chris Christie, pat himself so hard on the back that he's going to have to go for a chiropractic adjustment tomorrow?
He was patting himself quite a bit on the back. And also what I found very, very interesting was Senate President Steve Sweeney got a million good mentions. Murphy got zero, right? And Sweeney, who's a more conservative guy than Christie in a lot of ways, got one good mention after another. So that was very interesting. And I thought, you know, he was warning. He was basically saying, you know, maybe we're better off if Sweeney runs the state. And Sweeney wanted to run against Murphy. I think Murphy's going to have hands full because Sweeney is one tough customer, knows how to block things he doesn't like, and, of course, is the, you know, is an associate of Democratic boss George Norcross, who Christie also commended for his work on universities and the hospitals down there in South Jersey. He spent a lot of time talking about all the great things he did for South Jersey, which, of course, is Norcross's. Didn't hear North Jersey City, Hoboken mentioned once.
No, and you probably would never hear those words drip from Shamu Chris Christie's lips. But I didn't hear anything about a dismal bond rating, the looming pension crisis. Maybe I wasn't paying.
He said a lot about the pension crisis, you know, and he said, and rightfully so, he's put in more money. He named the six prior governors, Republican and Democrat. All of them increased pensions without putting the money in. Kane, Whitman, Florio, McGreevy, Corzine. They all would just give these big, I mean, this guy DeFrancesco, who was in there for a cup of coffee, he gave the workers a 9% hike in their pensions in 2001, with no hike in the contributions. So it was, you know, Christie did put a lot of money in. Now, Murphy has promised to immediately fund the pensions, which costs about $4.5 billion out of a $34 billion budget. He doesn't have the money. The minute he comes in, he's going to have to say, gee, I can't put any more money in than Christie did. After demonizing, you know, Christie for not putting the money in, I don't know where Murphy thinks he's going to get the money.
Was there a mention, Paul Mulshine, of the migration out of the state of New Jersey, which has been continuous because of the high tax rates? Obviously, now with the Trump reform tax package, even more pressure on the middle class resident of New Jersey. Any discussion of how so many New Jerseyites are now residents of North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Texas?
Well, he did, to his credit, get rid of the estate tax and also the tax on pensions. Those were two things that were really driving people out of the state. Of course, the real problem is the property taxes, and as you know, they're so bad in North Jersey that it's hard to think of anybody doing anything about them. You talk to people who have like a three-bedroom house with a $20,000 tax bill, and you know, it's just that I've been railing at these guys for 20 years about how to fix it, but they don't listen to me. You know, nobody really wants to take that on.
You know. The governor, outgoing governor, Shamu Alefi Chris Christie, may have a chance to listen now as he sidles up outside of the Jersey Shore, where Paul has been known to knock a few back at some of the local gin mills. And maybe Paul Mulshine, he'll join you in solidarity, and he can discuss all the things he could have done in the 8 years in which he abandoned ship and decided to seek the prospect of becoming the next president of the United States. Oh, that makes me want to retch. That makes me want to vomit.
Curtis Sliwa.
The next mayor of the city of New York.
Drive at 5.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New Yorker.
77 WABC.
I believe I can fly. I believe I can touch the sky.
5:40 here on the drive home at 5. That's right, I'm back, ladies and gentlemen. Full time, full schedule. not only the 12 to 3 show, but obviously this, the Drive Home at 5, having successfully fought off the Grim Reaper as he tried to wrestle me and get me to take a dirt bath after that operation for chronic Crohn's disease that I underwent on December 13th. The staples, the stitches are out. I'm going through withdrawal, but I'm back on track. And I must say that whatever problems that we are all collectively experiencing right now, it pales in comparison to people who have been stuck in a third world airport known as JFK since that bomb cyclone hit back on Thursday. That's right. People are still stuck there at the international terminal. They can't escape. They can't follow in what that pedophile on a pedestal, R. Kelly, was saying is, I just want to fly. Because things have been so totally screwed up. It's an embarrassment for New York City. It's an embarrassment for New York State and New Jersey. They run the Port Authority. But it just seems that our elected officials don't care. So I've asked to come on the line, Jason Rabinowitz of the New York Post, and explain to us why JFK became hell on earth. Thanks for joining us here on the Drive Home at 5, Jason.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so take us through the course of events that have led to this black eye that we've all absorbed because of the impotence or the incompetence of those who run the Port Authority and specifically JFK.
So, as you mentioned, the bomb cyclone kind of hit JFK in a little bit of an unexpected ferocity. The forecast wasn't all that bad, 8 inches of snow, but it progressively got worse and worse throughout Thursday to the point where the Port Authority had said, okay, we're going to close the airport. We're going to reopen at 1. No, wait, never mind, 3 o'clock. No, wait, never mind, 8 p.m. No, wait, we're done for the day. Come back tomorrow, and maybe we'll have our act together by then. But at that point, you had dozens of aircraft from all over the world, from Europe, from Asia, South America, all converging on JFK at the same point, at the same exact time. So they all had to divert elsewhere, whether that be Washington, D.C., or Baltimore, or even Toronto up in Canada. What really triggered the events at JFK was when all of these aircraft tried coming back about 24 hours later at the same exact time to JFK. So on Saturday, you had not only the regular operations that would take place at JFK, but an entire day's worth of aircraft that were supposed to land the prior day all coming back at the same time. And it just completely overwhelmed the already extremely fragile systems and terminals at JFK.
Now, Jason, we saw stuck on the floor, stuck in the chairs, passengers who were stranded, whether they were trying to leave town or they were trying to hook up with a connecting flight, whatever their dilemma was. I noticed that none of our elected officials who are like lens lights, they can't wait for a photo opportunity, bothered to show up to just show some compassion, whether it was Governor Cuomo or Mayor de Blasio, or even members of the Port Authority brass themselves. Why is it that they so distance themselves from this looming disaster?
Everyone knows JFK and really our three airports in the New York City area are kind of a mess. And no official is going to want to come out to JFK and really make themselves the face of the debacle that's happening there. You had aircraft coming in waiting 6-7 hours for a gate, literally sitting there overnight after a 15-hour flight, with people trapped on these aircraft that just could not come out. The Port Authority had done such a poor job managing its airport, saying, okay, this aircraft has been on the ground for 6 hours. It's not getting a gate at Terminal 1. Let's see that these passengers get off and get to another gate somehow. That just didn't happen. And JFK is, and our airports are just not something politicians want to get involved in because they know they can't win.
And then the pipe busts, I guess it was Sunday morning, and more mishigash. How did that happen, and how come they couldn't resolve that?
So what seemed to happen there was insult to injury. On Sunday afternoon, the airport was finally starting to get back into normal operations, and then apparently in Terminal 4, which is owned and operated by this Terminal 4 group, the IAT group, this uninsulated standby fire sprinkler system, the pipe just burst. And these systems are high pressure, lots of water in them, and you can't just shut it off. So the Port Authority was very quick to point fingers and blame that this wasn't us, this was Terminal 4, but they were very quiet about what had happened the prior days. So what the water incident was really just adding fuel to the already raging fire at JFK, but it certainly did not help.
Now, I would have thought from a few years ago when JetBlue had its debacle at its terminal at JFK, in which passengers were stranded sometimes as long as 72 hours, that we would have learned a lot from that, because it really took, it put a real hurt on JetBlue, which is our local airline. They're based right in Queens. We didn't really learn much from that, did we?
So JetBlue actually coined the phrase Valentine's Day Massacre for that. They actually fired their founding CEO over that incident. JetBlue seems to have learned from that. They put their customer bill of rights in place for instances like this. But this incident was on a global scale. You have airlines from China and Europe, South America, all over the world, who aren't accustomed to how things work at JFK, because they really don't work. You have all these individual terminals that if you're flying into Terminal 1, your aircraft cannot go to Terminal 4 or 5 or 7. It has to go to 1. And if Terminal 1 is overburdened, sorry, you have to just sit there and wait. And that is just not how it works on a global scale.
Now, you know, when you walk into a Walmart, you see greeters everywhere that tend to be senior citizens. They try to guide you through the aisles or help you with whatever you need. One of the biggest complaints of the passengers who were stuck at Terminal 4 is that they had almost nobody to talk to, nobody who was assigned to sort of like help them, translate for them, reconnect for them, just hold their hand if necessary. Why was there such a void there in even trying to get volunteers or from local nonprofits to come out or even from the nearby embassies to lend a hand in helping these people segue through this crisis?
There are just so many entities involved at JFK. At the highest level, you have the Port Authority, which doesn't actually operate the terminals at JFK. Those are operated either by airlines or consortiums or smaller independent groups like Terminal 1. And then airlines contract with these terminals to use that space. On top of that, you actually need airline employees manned and ready to go at these terminals to be able to rebook hundreds or even thousands or tens of thousands of passengers. The amount of manpower necessary for that is just something airlines, the terminal, the Port Authority, they were just not expecting to need at that moment. And what happened is in the history books at this point.
Do appreciate it, Jason Rabinowitz. I recommend everybody, if you go online, get his article today in the New York Post about why JFK became hell on earth. Now, anyone who has used JFK knows it's a third world airport. It's a black eye for New York, New Jersey, and the Port Authority. And you would think this kind of udiscrazia, this double shanda, would shake into action our elected officials, especially the governor of New York, Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Bruta Cuomo, King Cuomo I. No. He was MIA, just like he was for all those subway derailments during the summer of hell.
Curtis Lewa.
Really trying to help our cause.
The Drive at 5.
We're very honored to have him here today.
77 WABC.
This ought to be the theme song for Steve Bannon. Because he's out at Breitbart, the Mercy family, the Medicis from Long Island, his mentors in allowing him that stage at Breitbart have decided that's it. We're yanking all of our financial support. Others have chimed in. So Steve Bannon is on the outside looking in, looking to reinvent himself. Now think, in this short period of time in the Trump administration from the time of his inauguration last year, first out the door was Lieutenant General Flynn. You couldn't be any more loyal to the president than Lieutenant General Flynn. He was out there on the campaign trail. He would warm up the audience. He would fire them up. Lock her up, lock her up, lock her up. The president adored him. And then he stuck the shiv in Trump. And he had to go. And now he's made a deal with Mueller. God only knows what he is going to tell or has already told the grand jury. Then we had Rinse Out Priebus. You remember the schlubby, nebbishy, former head of the RNC. He has been sent back to the Badger State, Paul Ryan State in Wisconsin, and we haven't heard not jack diddly squat from him. And now we see the total, complete annihilation and execution of Steve Bannon, who suddenly, all of a sudden,
people on the left have an interest in, because they figure he knows where all of Trump's bones are buried and who buried them. Almost the same way the Clintonistas hated Comey, and then all of a sudden they put him on a pedestal when he got fired by Trump. You watch. He's going to try to resurrect himself, Manning.